Welcome to the Aquarimax Audio Show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 32, recorded July 27th, 2010.
It's time again to gather the fish around the radio and listen to the dulcet sounds of Russ's voice telling you fishy things.
Sam, nobody has a radio anymore. Well, at least we're not on it.
Gather the fishies around the speakers.
Okay, that'll work. Okay. Sorry it's been so long, folks.
We went on vacation and we forgot to tell you that we were going.
That's okay. There's only like 3 people who listen anyway.
But now we're back!
Okay. Well, maybe more than 3, but that's okay.
3.5.
I'm not downplaying the contribution that you make as a listener.
We are glad that you listen.
Yeah. I was being self-disparaging, not in any way detracting from the great service that you do us by listening to us. And hopefully you find it interesting once in a while as well. So, let me set the stage. We have just undergone a summer storm. And as we gaze across the room, we see coolie loaches in a frenzy swimming near the surface of the water, responding to the variation in barometric pressure caused by the storm, or relating to the storm.
So it's very interesting, because usually they just sit on the bottom.
And they're swimming around, which is fun to see.
You said apparently they like to spawn when it rains in the wild, because there's more water and there's more food from runoff?
Well, a lot of fish use rain as a spawning trigger, often because the rain does bring, of course, more water, and that often connects smaller bodies of water with larger ones and so on, also brings food down into the water, nutrients and things that cause algae blooms, that cause plankton to grow and things like that, you know, freshwater zooplankton, also just food items that fall into the water, depending on the kind of fish and so on. It stimulates the ecological fish economy, so to speak, when you get a big rain. So it's a good time to spawn for a lot of fish.
So that's what they're looking to do, I suppose.
Yeah. Although I doubt we'll get any fry out of it, because our water's a little too hard for coolie loaches, and as far as I know. And they'll probably just eat their own eggs, even if they do spawn.
But it is interesting to see them participating in the behavior. And it's pretty amazing when you think about they're in a tank inside the house. The rain is not touching them in any way. It's not like they can see it where they're at, but they can still feel the change in pressure. I think that's pretty impressive.
They've got wee barometers inside them. That's pretty amazing. But anyway, yes, there we go. Well, one thing we'd like to talk about is something that related to our trip.
Yes, and how the grindleworms fared with that trip.
Yeah, see, we decided to take one of our soilless cultures with us, out of state, just to make sure that everything would be okay. And the other two soilless cultures we left here, and our big, huge redworm and grindle culture we left outside is normal. But anyway, we wanted to see how they would fare. Have done this before, but this was interesting. The last time I did it, I only brought the one culture that I had at the time, the one soilless culture, with me. But this time, with these 3 cultures, brought the one culture with us, and of course, with the same regime of feeding and maintenance and whatnot, it did fine. But the interesting thing was that after, how long were we gone? About 16 days?
2.5 weeks.
Around 16 days. We came back, and the cultures that we had left, normally they received daily maintenance, but they were doing just fine. Fared as well as the culture that we brought with us. I thought that was kind of fascinating.
It is very interesting.
I read somewhere, and I wish I could find it, but I can't, about how soilless cultures bounced back really quickly when there was a lapse in maintenance. But I did not expect it to be quite like that. It was almost as if we hadn't left. Amazing. So there you go.
Needless to
cultures.
Say, we were glad about that.
Yes.
We didn't have to redo them, so.
So soilless cultures, once again, there's kudos to soilless Grindel cultures, I say. Beautiful things. Now, we're going to talk about a new, relatively new acquisition.
Yes. We happened to get, well, not happened to, we got them on purpose, but we got some celestial pearl Danios.
Most of which we got about a little over a month ago, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And a few of which we got about a week ago.
So, tell us about celestial pearl Danios. How are they different from other, quote-unquote, normal Danios?
Normal Danios? Well, there is a pearl Danio, which is a different species. In fact, there are quite a few species of Danios. As many of you may know, the zebra Danio probably being the most commonly known and recognized. But there are quite a few Danios out there. And this particular species, quite new, comes from Myanmar and was collected there just a few years ago. I think probably around, and I'm not sure of the year exactly, but around 5 years ago, give or take. And they're very small, Danio. Very small indeed. The total length is less than 1 inch of an adult. And they're called the celestial pearl Danio because they have wee spots on a dark background that look a little like stars or pearls or whatever. So,
in fact, when they first came out with them, they called them something different. They call them galaxy...
Yes.
Rasboras?
Galaxy Rasboras.
And then they figured out they weren't a Raspora, they were Danios.
They were Danios. And Danios and Rasboras are related, but they replaced them in the Danio genus. I think the original scientific name was Celestichthys margaritatus, which means celestial fish that has pearls on it.
And what do they call it now? Is that
and
still what
I
they
think
call
it's
it?
Danio margaritatus, which is the pearled Danio.
Oh, okay.
So, I think that's what it is right now. It may have changed since last time I checked, but that's, I believe, where it has been taxonomically situated.
Excellent.
Yes.
They're very pretty little fish, but they are very little.
They're very, very small indeed. So, I have 9 of them in a 10-gallon tank with some coolie loaches and some red cherry shrimp and a lot of an almost indecent quantity of Java fern, narrow leaf and lace Java fern, which I thin regularly and it never seems to help.
So buy some from us.
Anyway, it's a CO2 supplemented tank, do-it-yourself CO2, so the Java fern goes like mad, and there's also some Richa in there, or Rikia for some of you if you call it that, and water sprite, and a little Java fern, Java moss, too. Anyway, yeah, that's basically the setup. We've got the heater off right now.
Since it's July.
It's July. Coolie loaches don't really like warm water. Celestial pearl Danios don't either. They spawn in fairly cool water, as the article in Aquarium Fish International mentions. I think that was what? Was that the May issue, I want to say? I could be wrong about that. But it was a fairly recent issue, and they mentioned that the spawning temperatures from low 60s to mid 70s. We definitely don't need a heater in the summer here, where we are. And the coolie loaches don't either.
Now, while you're talking about them spawning, I remember you said they don't have to be very old.
No. No, the same article mentioned that they can spawn at about 10 weeks old. So...
Babies having babies!
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about that. Well, actually, I'm pretty happy about it because... my fish are probably quite old enough. They're very visibly male and female now. When I first got them, which, as I said, was about
a little over a month ago,
you couldn't really distinguish them very well. Now, there are a couple of ways that you're supposed to be able to distinguish them. When they're young, the females are supposed to have a dark spot around the vent. Somewhat like live bearers do, although not as pronounced as live bearers. and it's referred to as the gravid spot, much as that of guppies and other live bearers is. It's supposed to be more pronounced than any dark spots that the males might have. I've found that to be somewhat true, but not as reliable with the little fish, because then the spot's so teeny. Maybe if you took a picture of them and blew it up or something, but just following these wee fish around the tank trying to figure out who has the darker spot on the vent and how it relates in size to the other ones was a bit tricky for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I was at first dismayed, thinking, oh, I have all females. I wish I had a couple of males. But after just about a week or two, the males started demonstrating that they were males. The fins on the males started turning kind of an orange color with black stripes in them.
Ooh.
And the dorsal surface of the fish got kind of an orange striping all along it, as well as the belly. So it's kind of like the fish is outlined in this orangey reddy color, and then the fins have black stripes in them, several of the fins do. Most notably the dorsal, the anal, and the caudal fins have this black and orange striping. Some of the females have a little bit of orange in their fins too, but not so much black. And the anal fins tend to be quite clear in the females.
Interesting.
But they have that orange and black coloring in the males. And the males are also slimmer, which is true of most related fish. So the stocky ones with the dark spot at the vent with not so much color in the fins are the females. And there you go. That's about it for distinguishing gender here in these fish.
Okay.
Behaviorally, too, the males tend to be a little squabbly with each other, and they tend to chase the females around. But basically, they have an interesting spawning strategy. If you keep males and females together, apparently, and the temperature and other spawning environmental cues are present, then they'll just kind of spawn a little bit every day.
Like just like a few eggs every day?
Yeah, like some of the other fish we know, like white clouds will do that. Rainbow fish tend to do that. Some of the rainbow fish, anyway. Some of the killifish will do that. So a lot of fish have that strategy. If they're together, they'll just spawn a little bit almost every day or every day. And supposedly, if you keep them in the tank where there's nothing to eat them and there's enough food for the babies to eat, then you'll just eventually, you know, you'll slowly see the group grow.
Now, if they were in the wild, what would the advantage be to doing that? They could travel more and put more babies in more places? What is the reason?
Well, that's a good question. But it's kind of the strategy that if conditions are good right now,
mm-hmm.
and you produce a few babies, maybe conditions won't be good in 2 weeks. But they're good now for the babies to hatch and grow, then you'll get a lot of babies. And if you, rather than waiting and saving the eggs forever, and then it's not ready.
They're sort of planning then on there being several days where the conditions are good, rather than, oh, today's a good day, I better lay them all right now because tomorrow might not be a good day?
Well, I don't know how much the fish actually plan about
Well, you know what I mean.
If you're evolutionarily speaking,
yeah.
it could be that they... The conditions tend to be right during a large part of the year,
mm-hmm.
and so it makes sense for these fish, which probably don't have very long lifespans and may end up being preyed upon fairly frequently, to start spawning early and just keep going as long as they can, rather than trying to save up for a very special event that mm-hmm. may or may not get to. And so that seems to work. Although, if you separate the males and females, you can get the females to store up some eggs, and then have them spawn and produce a larger number. That's true with a lot of fish. They'll
what is their lifespan?
I don't know, but I would expect with their size being as small as it is that it's probably not very long. That's typical.
Like a couple of years, maybe?
Probably something like that. It could be longer. It could be more. I mean, some danios, I've seen danios live quite a long time. In excess of, just zebra danios live in excess of 3 years, probably more like 5 or so. And that's probably not even a record. So, but I would expect that these have a shorter lifespan because small fish tend to have very short lifespans. So I would expect no more than a year in the wild, probably less. But, you know, I'm not an expert on what goes on with wild celestial prodanios. That's just speculation.
No, you totally are, because I know you sneak out of the house at night and you go and
all the way to Myanmar.
All the way to Myanmar and watch them, and then you get all the way back before the alarm goes off in the morning.
Okay.
You were trying to hide it from me, but...
This is getting weird.
Well, it always does.
Okay.
That's okay. The other cool thing about celestial prodanios, you said, is that they school really well.
Well, they seem to, so far.
If you have a nice big group of them.
The ones that I've seen when they've been in big schools tend to school fairly tightly, so I'm hoping to get a nice big school by breeding these. I'm trying to decide how I want to do it. If I just want to put them in a small, put a, one female in a small tank and conditioner and put a male in there and let them spawn in a big group, or if I just want to try to get this group to slowly build up, or a combination of both.
I think you should just leave them all in there together, because, I mean, really, who wants an arranged spawning?
Well, I don't know. Maybe Danios go for that kind of thing. Who knows? We'll have to see. But when you do spawn them, they like small food.
Like what?
Well, infusoria would...
You mean the babies do, or the grown-ups like it while they're spawning?
The babies do, but we'll get back to the adults too, but since we're kind of talking about spawning.
Okay.
Infusoria would be good, vinegar eels. You can give them microworms too.
Can they handle them when they're really little or when they're a little bit older?
They can actually handle them because microworms are very thin. And in any, you know, proportion, any portion of microworms you give them, they're bound to be some really small, baby little ones. So the smallest celestial prodanias can go for those little ones. As long as they get enough of those, they'll soon grow big enough to get to the other ones. So you can do that, but you could always do infusoria first for a couple of days to help them out. I'm actually interested about this because I tend to have, in a tank where I keep bristlenose plecos and feed them a lot of veggies, kind of infusoria in the water a little bit already. It's kind of floating around. So I'm interested in seeing what would happen if I were to put the celestial prodanias in there, where the infusoria is already there, and let them go. Because I don't think the bristlenoses would really go after the danio eggs preferentially. They'd probably eat them if they happened to get to them, but they don't really eat off of the java moss or anything, so hopefully that would work, and that infusoria would help provide an early food source for them. They'd do well. They're just egg scatterers as far as I know, but they choose substrates like java moss or other fine-leaved sort of plants to spawn on, from what I've been able to ascertain. But we should get back to how, and again, some of this information comes from that article in the Aquarium Fish magazine, the Aquarium Fish International magazine. And another good resource for information is celestialprodanio.com. I got some good information from that website, so if you're interested, check that out too. Okay, so where were we? Food.
Yes, you were going to tell us what the grown-ups eat.
Yes. Well, I've noticed that they're kind of picky, and I'm not the only one to notice that. They do tend to be a bit picky about food. They like microworms, Walter worms, and banana worms, which are the ones I've tried so far. As far as the teeny worms, I haven't tried everything, I guess. But I've tried grindle worms too, actually. They really like grindle worms, most of them.
That's good.
Those are the worms that I've tried, and they like all of those. I've tried some pelletized food and some flake food, which they do okay with, but they're not as...
Excited about it.
They seem a lot more excited about the worms. So they get a lot of worms, but I try to give them at least one feeding of prepared food a day and a couple of feedings of worms because they can't eat all that much at once. And I keep a couple of assassin snails in the tank to help clean things up. The coolie loaches help too. I think, though, because I've noticed problems with hydra when you feed too many microworms, the assassin snails in the tank seem to be keeping the hydra.
The assassin snails
control.
Eat the hydra?
They seem to. I know not everyone will agree with me on that, but that's what I seem to have noticed.
That's very interesting.
I had a tank, a guppy tank, to which I added large quantities of microworms, and then I ended up having some hydra in there. So I put some assassin snails in there, and then hydra disappeared. Can't find one in that tank anymore. And some hydra started showing up in this tank, just a few. I put in some assassin snails, and I don't see hardly any, one or two once in a while. But
that's pretty cool.
Considering the amount of microbes that are going in there, I should be seeing more hydra, but I'm not. So that's pretty neat. It's just an observation. I don't have any empirical evidence. That's just anecdotal, folks. Doesn't get any better than that from me right now. So, picky eaters. I have given them frozen copepods. They like those, too. Yeah, I think those are all the foods that I've tried so far. I'm sure they'd be great with newly hatched baby brine shrimp, but I haven't tried that yet. I guess I'll have to do that sooner or later. Yeah. So they are a little picky. They like cool temperatures. They're interesting. In the pet store when I saw them, they were in a little 5-gallon tank, and there were about 30 of them. And they were just swimming in tight schools. And I know in pet stores, you know, they tend to swim in tight schools anyway. A lot of fish do, because they're in the groups and they're kind of scared. But I just sort of get the impression that they'll school fairly well. I guess we'll have to see how that bears out, but they are kind of skittish, and I think that actually helps for that.
If they want to stay more in the group.
Yeah, they're kind of skittish. I've noticed when I go by the tank, when I first get there, they all retreat into the plants, and then if I wait there for a moment, they'll come back out. But, you know, a lot of fish, after just a week or so, they know you're the food source, and boom, they're up at the top, ready for you to feed them, or they're dancing up against the glass, ready for you to feed them. These aren't doing that. In fact, they don't really appear to eat from the surface much, hardly at all. They usually wait till something sinks past them in the mid to lower water level, and then they'll go after it. But I hardly ever see them eating at the surface. And I don't believe I'm alone in that observation either. So there we go. I will let you know what I decide to do as far as spawning them, and chronicle my spawning of celestial pearl danios a little bit more in the future. Anything else we need to mention?
I think that's good.
Okay, well, oh, I should say one thing that was kind of fun.
What?
This is not related to celestial pearl danios, but when we were on our vacation, we went on a hike to an area that we customarily hike to when we're out there. A huge granite formation, the little creek at the bottom. There's a lake at the top, a creek down at the bottom. But we tend to go there anyway. We looked down at the creek. There was just a trickle of water in there, hardly anything. How deep was it? Like 2 inches deep?
Yeah, maybe.
And down at the bottom of this little crevice and everything. We went down there. I saw some water striders, and I went down to take a photo of the water striders and to point them out to the kids. And what did I see in the water but a huge number of crayfish? It was very interesting. In this little trickle of water, there were probably no more than 15 gallons of water down there in the little depression in that part of the creek that we were looking at. And the water was just barely trickling into that from a little higher up. And there were all kinds of really small crayfish. The biggest one I saw was maybe 2 inches long or a little longer, but there were a whole bunch of them that were less than an inch long, maybe 3/4 of an inch long, and even smaller than that, and that was fun to see. Just all gathered together, and I took a couple of pictures.
Maybe we could put the pictures on the resource page just for fun.
We could. I've been trying to take a couple of pictures of the celestial pearl danios, but dang, that's
hard
to do.
They're so small, and they move so fast.
Yeah, and they're so skittish. So I'll see what I can do, but I'm not promising anything yet. But if you want to see what the male and female look like, you know, go to celestialpearldanio.com, and they have a link there that has some really good photos and how to distinguish them. So check that out. I'll put the link on the resources page. And there you go.
Have a good night.
We'll try not to make the gap between this show and the next show nearly as long as the previous one. Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0000. 0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.